Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Hey, welcome to the Movies, Films, and Flicks podcast, everyone. I'm your host, John Losva. Joining me, as always, are my co-hosts, Mark Hoffmeyer.
So, I stopped by, I went and watched this Halloween screening of the movie Halloween, an early one. And as we were leaving my wife and her friends, we stopped by this taco joint. And we're at this taco joint, and there's like this weird stuntman there, and he starts talking to one of my wife's friends. And, you know, as soon as we know it, we're eating tacos, and she's dancing by a jukebox, and he's just acting all shifty, you know, and we eventually get in the car to drive away, and, you know, we really don't think anything about him. And, you know, we're going, and this car just flies by. I have no idea what it is, but, you know, whatever. I'm happy. I'm eating my taco. And we're going further down the road, and I drop my taco. I bend down to pick it up, and my car swerves, and I feel this car going right past me going, phoof, and it completely missed me because I went down to pick up my taco. And apparently it was some guy named Stuntman Mike that, like, kills women by crashing into them, and he totally got killed. So,
oh man,
the taco saved my life.
The taco saved your life.
Wait. In the movie, was it a taco place where they met him? I didn't remember. Yeah.
No, it was in Austin, some chili taco, something like that.
Yeah.
But you know, this is a different spot. You know, obviously.
Yeah.
So you know, I was just enjoying a nice, you know, taco, and it was good. You know, nice breakfast taco. We don't call them breakfast burritos, and it was good. You know, but I got lucky. That taco saved my life.
Let's be honest, Mark. You were at Taco Bell.
let's not
get all hoity-toity. You were at Taco Bell. Yeah.
I want to win that gold Xbox or whatever that is.
A gold PS4? Yeah, I know sure. You're joking, but I've actually entered that a couple times.
Oh, nice. I just play Mario Kart on Wii, so I don't really need a new gaming system, unless I can play PS3 Blu-rays on it.
I don't think it's actually a golden like a PS4, because if I won it, I would melt it down and just sell the gold.
You would smelt it? Is that what the word is?
Pretty much, yeah.
You'd have a big chain, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah, I would, actually. And it would hang low. Love and good. How many tacos can you eat in a single sitting?
Oh, yeah. God, how many tacos are there?
Well, I mean, all right, so let's say there's just a buffet, right? All the toppings you could eat.
An all-you-can-eat Mexican buffet.
Yeah. Well, that would, you know what slowed me down is that I'd put too much on each taco to get a proper estimate of how many tacos I could eat. But if we're talking just like hard or soft taco supremes at Taco Bell, I mean, it's significantly more than 15. It's up in like the, I don't know, 20 to 30 range, I think.
I don't know if you guys remember, they might still be around your area, but the old buffet restaurant, Ponderosa, like steakhouses.
I've only ever seen that in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Yeah, probably. But like they had like a buffet section, and they had like an area where you can make your own tacos, and it was like all you can eat. I remember as a kid, like I basically just cleared out like the entire taco section. Like I would just basically, I would like get some lettuce and some sour cream and cheese, but that would be minimal. I would just load it up with like nothing but taco meat, like all the way up to the top.
You just wanted that protein.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how I was not a chubby kid back then.
I mean, all those trips back and forth.
Yeah, that's true. But I don't know. I haven't attempted to just like scarf down like a smorgasbord of tacos.
It just sounds tiring.
Yeah. I don't know. I've eaten the 10 pack at Taco Bell.
Oh, jeez Louise.
That's nothing though. I don't know.
No. Oh, I can put down a 10 pack and like it's like my hands are still reaching down like looking for more. I'm still in the motion. Like I haven't slowed down at the end of a 10 pack.
I used to go to Taco Bell after high school and just like order like an entire grande meal for myself.
You know what I do up here is I go to Taco Mac in Atlanta. It's just a place that has over 100 beers on tap. That's like my new Taco Bell. I just go there and drink craft beers.
Oh. Why didn't you take me there when I was around?
Because Megan was too busy making you delicious dinners.
She was always making amazing
dinners. Listen, love and good. Mark loves you, but he's not in love with you. Sorry. Sorry.
That's the reason.
All right. Mark.
Next week on Taco Talk.
Yeah. Mark, I think you have the listener questions this week.
Yeah, this first one is from Will the Cook, and it says, if Team America World Police were to battle a Sharknado, who would win and how many cities would be destroyed in the process? Now, I kind of think they would either destroy a city to prevent the Sharknado from being able to destroy the city, or I think if they were chasing terrorists, they would lead the Sharknado into the terrorist's place, thus destroying several cities to get to that terrorist, you know, stronghold.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think they would use the Sharknado as a weapon, and it would just kill thousands. So I'm thinking three cities.
But what does Matt Damon do in all this?
He gets killed in the second city.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Matt Damon.
The marionette, though. He lit.
My curiosity is this like the Marvel Universe where it's like, we know that the Avengers exist, but there's like one sentence that explains like an Iron Man 3 is like, I just don't want to bother them with this. They're dealing with something right now. Is that why the Avengers aren't handling it and why Team America is?
Like, they're like dealing with something on like, you know, this is taking place on the East Coast. They're dealing with something on the West Coast, you know?
They're still on like, top of that floating city.
Yeah, they're still floating around on some city. Controlled by James Spader.
So my theory is this. It's that however many cities the Sharknado would have destroyed, it'll be that many cities plus one that are destroyed after Team America succeeds. Because like I think that like the Sharknado will have almost run its course, and it's about to like fizzle out like any NATO would, and then, you know, the sharks will just drop into Tampa Bay or something. And, except then just like when that was about to happen, that's when Team America unleashes the nuke on the city where it was going to fizzle out. And then they claim all of the praise for ending the Sharknado when it had run its course already. Like, they showed up late.
I want to see a map of this. Like, you know, you're in space, just see a swath of destruction.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think, Lazabeth? How many cities?
I'm going to go with zero.
Ooh.
The reason why is because I think the whole hurricane tornado thing has kind of played out. I mean, we just recently had Hurricane Patricia, the strongest hurricane ever recorded. It had a death toll of zero. So I don't know. I think hurricanes have jumped a shark. No pun intended. Right.
Oh.
And plus, as far as Team America goes, I think they're the ones that actually like destroy a city, trying to prevent like a disaster. Even though like they would have, it was totally unnecessary. But like they're the ones causing destruction, trying to prevent something that probably wasn't going
to
happen.
Yeah, they destroy the city to make rubble to prevent the thing from moving forward, you know, and then it just fizzles out before it even gets there.
I was like, oh, man.
So it'd be like a Man of Steel type city after they were done with it.
Yeah.
I love it.
And the Sharknado just fizzles out before it makes landfall.
So the answer is Fonzie from Happy Days?
Pretty much.
So after Team America like dispenses of the Sharknado, then the Avengers show up as Team America puppets.
I want a movie about that. Give me an episode of that.
Like that's the scene that'll happen after all the credits.
I do kind of love that, how like the world's like in the balance, and then they're like, "Where's Iron Man?" Ah, man, he's a Taco Bell.
Yeah. It's like, we're all of the Avengers. All of the Avengers are busy. I've got to get my crap together and handle this. like Thor can't get over here, even though I'm just on the other side of the U.S. Thor can't get over here in his 3 minutes and have that be in time to help me for a few minutes.
I love it. So we're blaming it all on Thor.
Yeah, pretty much.
Thor, yeah. Yeah. All right.
So Thor destroys the cities.
Because Thor's girlfriend can just, like, open up that portal and teleport him.
Yeah, that's right. He's like a jumper.
Yeah.
Dude, that movie Jumper was ahead of its time.
Hey, you know, the only bad thing I have to say about two bad things. One, I don't know why they use the word paladin. I don't like that holy knight thing. And two, Hayden Christensen is pretty annoying. But if you ignore those two facts, I actually love, love, love that movie.
So if the main character who's on screen every second wasn't annoying?
But, you know, I still love
I'm joking. I love the idea, yeah.
I still like the character. It's just that whoever plays that character, when it's Hayden Christensen, it's a whinier version of that character.
I like the world established. You have, like, all these, like, beings that could just kind of teleport anywhere. Like, I like that idea. It's just the main character was Neil.
It's a nice fantasy.
There we go.
Yeah.
Love that movie. All right. Perfect. So thank you, Will. That was awesome. We know you're listening. And yeah. Next question is, what Halloween-themed cinematic dance party would you want to go to? And I think I kind of softballed this to Lazavath. When this question was asked to me, I knew Lazavath would have an answer.
Oh, yeah. I mentioned this movie before.
Can I say it?
Yeah.
Idle Hands?
Yes.
Yeah. But doesn't that party, like, don't a lot of people die?
Yeah, they die, like, when the hand, like, gets loose and he starts, like, murdering people. But, like, the thing is, before that, they were having fun. Everybody was in costumes. Jessica Alba was there. The Offspring were playing, like, their set.
That was one of those dance parties where everyone is dancing.
Yeah.
And, like, it's all, like, everyone's having the best time of their lives.
Have you guys ever been to a party where everybody was dancing? I don't think I have.
No, I don't think I have either.
Like, there's always somebody, usually me, who's not dancing.
I know two parties where that's not true. One is the Blade Rave.
Oh, yeah, where everyone's just dancing in the blood. Well, they're all vampires.
Every single person was, except for the guy, just to, like, talk about how cool it was. But then he just started it and then got eaten, right? And then two is actually one of my, I got a tie, two picks. The two is one of my picks, and that's the Halloween party in Hocus Pocus. Because the witches cast a spell, Bette Midler, Sarah Jessica Parker, and the other actress, they cast a spell so that everyone, like, would just continuously dance forever, like, until they died at the party. Like, they were possessed. Like, Weekend at Bernie's 2, basically. When the music's on, they dance. And so they just kept dancing. And the reason I like that is because I can't dance. And this way, I would be forced magically to dance, and I couldn't even stop when I got frazzled. I just keep going.
You could really learn some stuff about yourself.
I'd be a dancing machine. Like, I'm doing the dance moves right now. But the other thing I thought of, just on a bro level, is the Night of the Demons remake. And that movie was utter garbage. But that movie, on a per capita basis, had the most attractive women in it than, like, any other Halloween party in a movie ever. Like, and Shannon Elizabeth was there. And Dura Baird from the Texas Chainsaw remake, she was there. Linnea Quigley, even though she's, you know, not young anymore, like the ultimate scream queen, she's there. Like, it's a pretty cool Halloween party for a horror fan.
I just want to see you dancing. I think you would learn a lot about yourself.
You want to see me at the Hocus Pocus party?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think everybody would learn a lot about themselves if they were forced to dance for hours.
Like, it's like gun to your head. Like, you don't even get to stop and say, like, oh shit, I got a thing for. No, you just go.
Just go.
I would learn that I hate dancing.
So for me, this is random, but I picked two. I think the Mean Girls one would be fun to go to, just because, like, the dialogue in that was so witty. I feel like everybody in that school was, like, way hyper intelligent, so the conversations that you're having would be pretty cool. But the one I'd want to go to is a Donnie Darko party, because it just seems so chill. Like, everyone's just sort of hanging out. Like, there's plenty of people there, there's a lot of booze, everyone's just sort of relaxed. Like, I'm not a club guy, I'm a pub guy. And, like, this seems like the pub of parties, you know, like a full pub. And so I would dig some Donnie Darko Halloween partying, because it's just sort of chill. You know what I mean?
But then you would have no idea what was going on after a couple of drinks.
Yeah, which exactly. Yeah, like, just hanging out.
Yeah.
I'll go to a Halloween party and just chill. I'm down for that. I'll show up as Hank Solo, the redneck Han Solo.
You know, I love Halloween, but I hate dressing up in costume.
Really?
Yeah, it's weird, you know.
Just be a redneck Star Wars character. They're the best. I saw a guy did Bubba Fett, and so I copied him and did Hank Solo. So I did a redneck Han Solo.
Yeah.
But loved it. Loved it. So, yeah, cool. So the answer to that is Hank Solo.
Yeah.
That's the answer to the question.
Yeah.
Which Halloween party in a movie? Hank Solo. Yeah.
I think that's pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
All right. And, all right. I think that does it for listener questions for now. And honestly, I'm not doing this on purpose, but who has the topic this week?
You know, this was a mutually chosen topic, but I am, in fact, the purported leader of this topic for the week.
Just to let everybody know at home, I don't prepare for these shows. You know, I just show up, I hit record, and then we just kind of wing it.
Well, you watch the movies, right?
Yeah.
We interact for like 30 minutes before we start recording, and yet that was still not hashed out.
We talk about everything but the podcast, actually. Yeah, whatever. All right, love good.
Taco talk.
Yeah.
All right, so back in episode 16, we compared very critically the original Poltergeist from 1982 to the remake of Poltergeist from 2015. Now that Halloween is upon us, and in fact, Halloween is just in a couple days from the time that you might be listening to this pod, we thought that we would compare Rob Zombie's 2007 Halloween to the original 1978 Halloween. And this is kind of interesting because Rob Zombie, he's a pretty brutal filmmaker. That's really all he gets most of his attention for, except for some specific films, is brutal, 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 gory, brutal, mean. And then you have the 1978 Halloween, which is heralded before most discussions as either the quintessential slasher movie or one of the game-changing slasher movies, a true classic horror. You know, there's a lot of praise behind that movie. And then in the case of any old movie, there always comes some question to newer viewers of, you know, do you like it as much as you used to? What still works? And how did it change the game for the genre that came after it? So again, today we're going to delve deep into comparing these two movies. We're going to start by talking about Halloween, and then we'll We're going to start by talking about 1978 Halloween.
Oh, okay.
And then we'll go ahead and later transition into 2007 Halloween, mostly comparing them. And hopefully, if Rob Zombie listens at the end of this podcast, he won't put out a hit on all of us.
No, I love Devil's Rejects.
Sorry, yeah, love Devil's Rejects.
Well, I think Devil's Rejects is a very good film. I don't know how many times I could watch it because it feels like hiking up a mountain in the rain, getting
punched in the face.
Yeah, and then like a year later, when you think about it, you're like, it wasn't that bad. But there was artistry to it. I will say. I think that he captured a film with that movie.
I've done that before, hiking up a hill in the rain, but about the getting punched in the face.
Nice.
Yeah.
It wasn't in Florida, because that would take like 2 minutes.
I was somewhere in Tallahassee, actually. But
Well, Tallahassee's north Florida.
Yeah, whatever.
And also, in the spirit of a fair conversation, I've actually listened to a lot of podcasts, actually out of curiosity to hear other people's opinions. And people's opinions really shift wildly with how recently they have or haven't seen a movie sometimes. And so we all have seen these movies, the original and the remake, recently. So it's not like we're thinking back to what we think we feel or what we felt back when we were a kid or something. We've seen these movies recently, so this is a legitimate conversation.
I like it. So, like, when did you guys first watch Halloween? What was your first experience with Halloween?
I think it was in middle school. It was one of those video store rentals. It was like, I want to say, like, during the summer, maybe. I don't know. I definitely didn't watch it at Halloween. That would have been cool. But I remember, it was around the same time I was going through, like, a bunch of old horror, like, the classics. Like, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Halloween, the first couple Friday the 13th. I think I was just binge-watching, like, all these old movies. And they were scary, you know, for me back then when I was younger. And, yeah, just watching, like, the original Halloween, I remember thinking to myself, like, well, this is actually scarier than I thought it would be. Because back then, I kind of had the notion, like, the older the movie is, like, the less scary it is. Like,
you're thinking of, like, Brides of Dracula, where you just watch and roll your eyes at the 1936 movie kind of thing, right?
You know, younger me didn't realize that, like, horror movies from that time were, like, completely out there. They were brutal.
Dude, actually, the 70s are crazy.
Yeah. I was finding that out. Like, back then, I'm just like, oh, man, what am I getting myself into? But, yeah. I think that just kind of opened. I think Halloween it's like a gateway drug for like horror movies.
And so what age would you say, John?
I was somewhere in middle school. I want to say like 12, 13 maybe.
So for me, I can confidently say it was somewhere between late fourth grade and sixth grade, because my best friend at the time, Brett Henriksen, hi Brett, if you're listening, by the way, he might be the guy who actually got me into horror, by the way, way back in the day. But we would marathon, like, we'd stay up all night for sleepovers and marathon Freddy movies, marathon Jason movies, watch TV marathons when they'd come on horror wise like on around Halloween. And so I would have been, you know,
10 to 12. And I can comfortably say that back then, that was a pretty scary movie for me back then. Nowadays, for a 12-year-old with all the movies that they get to see, I think it's going to be creepy for them. But, like, I don't know how scary it would be. But back then, Halloween was a scary, scary experience. I didn't have a lot to go on. But Halloween was creepy as hell for me back then. And, again, probably 10 or 12.
I was 18.
Oh, nice.
And my mom was out of town, so I was in the apartment by myself. And I was in high school, and I remember I wanted to watch a bunch of scary movies. I was going through a phase like you did, John, going to Blockbuster and renting the movies. And I took my mom's Carlos Rossi, like, you know, those like gallon wine jugs with like, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, my mother had those too.
And I sat it on my lap. I was probably wearing jean shorts. And I just sat on a couch in the dark, complete darkness, and watched it. And like, it was pretty awesome. Alone. You know, yeah, alone. You're 18 years old. You got Carlos Rossi in you. And you're watching this movie, you know, no one's going to be there that night. So I was like,
I'm picturing you sitting on the couch in jorts, shirtless, drinking gallons of wine, watching Michael Myers just like slashing up like teenage girls.
Yeah, that was pretty much, that was my high school yearbook quote, actually, what you just said. And I had the hookah necklace or hoopa necklace or whatever the heck you call it. The white coral shells or whatever they are.
Yeah, you're living the dream, my friend.
I was crushing it.
Yeah.
But no, it was great. I loved every second of it, man. And it opened up so many more doors to me as far as horror went. And that's like after that, I went and hunted out and watched with my friends like Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah,
I kind of worked my way backwards. Like Halloween was 78, Texas Chainsaw Massacre was 74, then Deliverance was 72, Night of the Living Dead was 68. So I kind of like worked my way back.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I'm done.
Oh, just to digress a little, like I mentioned, it opened up doors. I mean, one of the most important doors that Halloween opened up for me was John Carpenter movies. You know, after watching Halloween, I thought like, well, I want to watch more Halloween movies. But then I found out, you know, John Carpenter didn't really direct like all the Halloween like installments. So I'm like, well, what else did he do? And then I saw he did the Escape from New York, The Thing, and also Big Trouble in Little China. I'm just like, oh my god!
Like, was that why you wore sleeveless shirts for like 4 years?
Yeah, yeah.
After watching Kurt Russell in his sleeveless shirts,
I was wearing sleeveless shirts. I had a mullet, and it was glorious.
And you had a knife everywhere. You went and a fake Uzi.
And I don't know how many minutes we are into this podcast, but that's the Kurt Russell bell. Like, ding, we have now discussed Kurt Russell on a tangent already.
But also, quick little thing. Like, I didn't realize it until I just rewatched the movie again recently. But, like, there's a scene in Halloween where I think, like, the kid and Laurie, Jamie Lee Curtis's character, they're watching, like, an old... like a horror movie, and it's the old RKO production of The Thing.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Oh wow. And I looked it up. Halloween came out before John Carpenter remade The Thing. I'm just like, so was this John Carpenter's way of telling people like, hey, this is my next movie, or is it just purely coincidence?
Well, he was probably just a fan for a really long time. That's probably what led to him wanting to remake it in the first place.
That's amazing. It's just a cool little thing I noticed. I'm like, oh wow. Nice.
And actually, before we potted, I just watched it again for a quick thing. And I noticed how much it follows, not steals, but like borrows from this film. Just the sweeping empty shots and like the walking scenes and the kind of dreamy atmosphere.
Like when Laurie's like walking through a neighborhood in Haddonfield, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like it's like your stereotypical sleepy American suburb. Like there's nobody on the streets, like except for her. And it's just like the houses, like they're your stereotypical like American family households. Like, it's just very normal looking. But then like you have like the juxtaposition of like this big huge dude in like some type of work outfit wearing like a scary looking mask. It was just really effective, you know. Like that whole first half of the movie, like it's just him stalking Laurie. It's amazing.
It's him being a jerk and knowing how to drive.
Yeah.
they comment. Dr. Loomis, Donald Pleasance's character, like he even comments on that when he says, you know, he's after he escapes from the mental hospital, and the cops are saying, well, how's he going to get to Haddonfield? It's 100 miles away. And he says, you know, he could drive there. He said he doesn't know how to drive. He says he could have learned. But, yeah, somehow he gets there. But I don't know. Maybe he could figure it out.
I mean, when he was young, he probably saw it, you know, and then maybe he was just, like, thinking – because he said he was always thinking about escaping.
Yeah. Well, how hard is it to learn how to drive a car, really?
Yeah, I mean, and also he's, like, pure evil, so, like, maybe something's guiding him.
I mean, pure evil might not, like, suffer from the natural frustrations and fidgetiness that comes with learning to drive.
I just imagine pure evil is, like, telling him in his head, all right, remember to check your rearview mirror. Check your side.
As we're delving into the beginning, it seems that we've now delved into the early part of the movie here. So when we first see Michael Myers, he's a six-year-old kid, right? First off, he's a pretty regular-sized-looking six-year-old kid. He's a pretty normal-looking six-year-old kid. If anything, a pretty, you know, good-looking, photogenic six-year-old kid. He looks normal. And this is both movies. In fact, he was a better-looking kid in the original than in the remake. But so in both movies, they even do this. But he's a normal-sized, normal-looking kid. And for some reason, when he's grown up, he is a preternaturally large person. And towards the end of the movie, we actually briefly see him unmasked, and his eyes are uneven. He is physically deformed all of the sudden. And so I get that we're going with this evil monstrosity, this pure evil notion, but, you know, that's kind of what I would call in filmmaking, and this is very fair, it's all over the place in films, and especially in horror, but I would call this pulling a fast one. Yeah. Because there's nothing to merit him being that big, and there's nothing to merit his deformity.
Well, watching it again, he's not that big in the first one. In the remake, he's a monster. But, like, in the first one, he's a bigger guy, but he's not, like... He's not burly or anything like that. He's not that old. Isn't he like 21?
Yeah. I think he goes like from like the original, like he was like an NFL size like person to like the remake where he's like an NBA size person.
He's like the great Khali.
So in the remake, he's like Nathan Jones.
Yeah, great Khali.
Not 7 feet tall, but I mean, he's like maybe 6'6" and he's got a huge frame in the second one. But yeah, the first one, it's not as you know, fantastic, if you will. But the deformity, though, his eyes are uneven like Sloth from the Goonies.
Well, maybe there was something in the food at the insane asylum that he was at that just kind of affected his pituitary gland.
Maybe they put him in underground fighting camps.
I mean, remember, like when you see it in the movie, this is something that's like, you know, it's shocking and it works. This is the kind of thing that I only really kind of realized well after I stopped watching the movie. So it's not like this affected my movie enjoying experience at all. It was just something that in hindsight I noticed and I realized and I thought, like, that was strange. Because when I looked back, it was a really good-looking kid.
Yeah. I think the most important thing I want to point out about that kid, though, is that you never hear him talk. You know, granted, it was a very brief appearance. Like, he was only in the movie for, like, 5 minutes. Even if that, but like you just kind of saw him just standing there with a knife, like he doesn't say anything. It's very unnerving.
Oh, no, there's no lines.
Yeah. It's very unnerving, like when you take the mask off, like you said, Living Good, like he's a sweet looking angelic kid, like you can't believe like he just stabbed his sister like that. So it's very it sets up the character of Michael Myers very well.
I guess that if they unmasked him and he looked like all handsome, like Paul Walker, it totally wouldn't have worked on screen.
Yeah.
So what I like, you know, this movie cost, you know, roughly nowadays with inflation, $1 million. And so what I like about it, they filmed it in 20 days. And I found out that Carpenter deferred a lot of his payments so they could use a Panaglide, which is nowadays called a Steadicam. Like, remember when Blu-ray and HD DVD were battling it out? Like, Panaglide was, like, another type of Steadicam. And that really sort of revolutionized this film. I mean, if you think about Deliverance, you know, they had the long shots. If you think about, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, they let the camera linger. But in this one, John Carpenter didn't have the time to do a lot of dolly shots because with dolly shots, you know, working on set, you got to put out a ton of track. And then you got to level it. Then you got to put the dolly on the track. Then you got to put the camera on the track. And then you got to do all the rehearsing. But with this Panaglide, it felt so natural. It felt like he was looking You know, it felt like you were just in this kid's head. And that was really rare for horror. So, I mean, I love how, once again, cheapness inspired, you know, an iconic type of lingering shot that he could move with.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
While you bring that up, I think that before this, in 1974, Black Christmas, that occasionally, like, showed you what the killer was seeing a little more than just an angle of the camera, but it wasn't quite the same as, like, looking through the mask holes of the little kid while the kid was stepping and, you know, his head is going up and down. And so, like, that true proper, like a first-person shooter game, like that POV done in that perfect way. I think, I'm pretty sure, this is the first movie that did that. Black Christmas might have come close, but it wasn't like this POV like we see, you know, so often now. Yeah. I think Carpenter, like, really pioneered that.
I think a subtle thing that he did to kind of add to the POV experience is that, like, there are moments where you can hear Michael Myers breathing, like, through his mask. It was like...
Yeah.
And it was just it's very creepy. And, like, it's easy to miss. Like, I was wearing headphones when I watched the movie. I'll admit, like, I never noticed it before because I never watched the movie wearing headphones.
You hear his breathing, like, throughout the movie. That's his thing.
Yeah, and it slowly gets more labored or, like, heavier, like, as the movie goes on. But it's a nice little creepy touch, I thought.
And you know what was interesting? I was Roger Ebert is a notorious hater of horror films, and he and Siskel and Ebert, I watched a YouTube clip where they reviewed Halloween, and they love it. And the reason Ebert said he loves Halloween is he said Halloween does not hate women. A couple of his other quotes, he said artistry can redeem subject matter, so it's done well, so it can, you know, redeem what, you know, teenagers getting killed. And he just said you can engage in the joy of filmmaking with this movie. And I thought that was pretty interesting how he said it doesn't hate women, because the women in this were. I mean, they, you know, like, they're obviously, you know, they're people are engaged in some pretty randy stuff, but they had personalities and they felt like lived in characters that you would sort of meet in the suburbs. I know a lot of people say it's just like the chass woman lives, but I mean, you go to any high school, like, you know, I don't know. I don't think that these kids were that bad. So a lot of people say it's just women getting murdered, but I also think that they didn't torture the women either, like in, you know, Last House on the Left or other films like that. So that's why Ebert loved it. So I thought that was kind of cool, my favorite movie reviewer. And he adored it because he felt like it didn't hate women.
Yeah. You know, back then, that seems like a fair criticism. But today, looking back, this movie actually got a lot of negative criticism from modern critics about how it portrayed women, even compared to other films of its time. Because those girls, they were continuously talking about sex. When Laurie says she forgets her books, the one says, "Oh, I always forget my books, my chemistry book, my physics, but I always forget my books. We don't need them." So, I mean, this movie compared to other films of the time actually kind of captured the stereotype of women as not needing to be smart. And in a horror movie, being the victim because of all the sex, if you will, and talking about getting beer and things. Like, even 4 years before in Black Christmas, those girls were all actually talking about things that had to do with life, whereas in Halloween, only Laurie Strode was, whereas all the other girls were just set up to be victims.
I mean, but I still think they served a purpose. I don't think it was just like, let's torture these women, like the death in the car. You know, you had the girl with the sheet, obviously, but I don't think they were... You know, being pushed to the extremes like they were.
Oh, no, that's very fair. Yes, that's
I mean, there were movies at this time that were like straight up, like, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. These movies were just like, you know, torturing. And so Ebert didn't get that feeling. So I mean,
I'll agree with that.
I mean, obviously they were fodder, but I think it was done well. And I think one thing that sullies that is they kind of inspired that kind of trope almost. And so I think people look back at it now as saying, you know, this started it. So they're hypercritical of it. I don't know. Like Saw, like James Wan hates torture porn. I mean, Saw was more than torture porn, but movies sort of adopted from that. So I think it's just kind of the catalyst. But and I think it's interesting all the criticism of Halloween nowadays and people saying it's not scary. But I don't think that's fair because, like, let's say Michael Jordan retires, right? And 35 years later, everyone's like, Michael Jordan's not as good of a basketball player now as he was back then. Like, it's not a fair criticism. I think at the time it was an immensely successful and influential film that really sparked horror and was independent. And it kind of was that 70s vibe that captured like a $300,000 film rookie, not a rookie filmmaker, but a younger filmmaker on a 20-day shoot. So I think it was very good and groundbreaking for what it was with the Panaglide shots. I think the darkness was perfect. You never know where people were going to hide. Yes, it gets a little cheesy with him kind of lurking in the background. But I don't know. I think at the time there was something people hadn't seen because they were used to more like – I don't think they were used to this kind of killer. Like you had Hitchcock with Norman Bates. Then you had The Night of the Living Dead. Then you had the rednecks from Deliverance. You had like the yuppies from Rosemary's Baby. You had the rednecks from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So this was like a new force, like an unstoppable, evil, no backstory. So I think, you know, people look at it now and say it's not scary. But I also think many films have mimicked that and the reputation and expectations are so high that it can't live up to that.
Well, first off, it's not that original. He's literally a combination of the killer from Black Christmas and Leatherface. Leatherface was basically an unstoppable, masked, oversized, evil, mute force. And in Black Christmas, you had someone who escaped from a mental hospital on the eve of a holiday, returned home, and then slowly picked off all the women who were there. And you basically never really see his true identity, nor does he speak either, other than the phone calls coming from inside the house. But you never see the killer speak. And John Carpenter was an outspoken fan of specifically Black Christmas. So it's no surprise that it emulated a lot of it.
Well, and he loved the movie Psycho, John Carpenter, but he hated the ending where they kind of explained Norman Bates as evil. And this is in the book Shock Value where he's talking about it. So he also made no backstory for Michael Myers. That's why Donald Pleasance kind of filled it in. So obviously there are inspirations, but I mean, it's a good look. It's a good character. I mean, I just think the movie was lightning in a bottle. So.
Yeah, I think you can, for me personally, you can clearly separate the movie into two halves. Like this is going to sound obvious, but you have the first half and the second half. The first half.
Oh, what?
Yeah. I know. We're getting in depth here. But the first half, like, it's a slow burn. You know, you have Michael Myers. Like, he's just slowly stalking Laurie. And it's just... I always thought it was hilarious. Like, Laurie would see him, like, hiding behind a bush. Like, she looks away for a second. Then she looks back, and he's gone. I'm like, where does he get that speed from? What is he, fucking Batman?
And when he jumped on that car, too, in the beginning. Like, he's like, got some speed.
But, like, you look in the second half of the movie, it's like he's chasing Laurie. And it's just like he's moving slow as molasses. Like, why aren't you using that jumper speed? He's just, like, teleporting everywhere.
So, yeah, when she's putting the kids into the room, then she hides in the closet. Like, he waits a while to walk really slowly. I mean, maybe he's like, playing games.
I don't know.
I mean, maybe he is that deranged because Donald Pleasance said he never wanted him to get out.
Yeah.
So, like, maybe this was, like, his deranged way of doing things.
I love,
on that, and that makes me think. So he went in as a child, and he never spoke, right? So we don't know how much he really learned from whatever television he had, but he never spoke or interacted with people. So when he is watching, I almost imagine that his stalking from a distance, you know how he stares and sits motionless out in the open, almost as if he doesn't realize people can see him? It's almost like a child, like playing hide and seek and covering their eyes, thinking you can't see them. It's like that his youth that he went in with was somewhat preserved, even though you added all this evil to the character, and that there's a childlike discovery to his stalking. He doesn't realize that running would help, so he doesn't.
And like, do you think, like, remember when he breaks on the car? That girl yells at him, then he breaks. Like, is he like messing with him? Like,
I would call that kind of like a natural, like the mistake anyone would make in writing a screenplay to have him do that, because that's like what the bro does or what the angry dad does. But either, you know, even still, like, he could just be responding to the fact that someone yelled something and he doesn't even know how to respond because he's never interacted really with anyone other than maybe Dr. Loomis and a nurse telling him to take a pill in 15 years.
Yeah. But I don't know. Like, just to return to my point, like, I think
Like, second sorry. Half or first half? Second half or first half?
Just it's crazy how like the first half, like it's just like a slow burn, like he's just like slowly stalking, but like the second half, like he really just ramps it up, you know. And it's just like it was really, I hate to say this because it makes me sound kind of weird, but like it was really satisfying to actually see him just like get to work, you know. It's just like you built up like this character, and like it's cool to see him like you know, do his thing. I'm like, yeah, this is Michael Myers. Like, it's cool to see him like kind of do his thing in his prime, you know.
In his prime,
yeah. He like picks that guy up and stabs him like in the chest.
Yeah, and he's just like he's kind of nailed there, like on the wall for a couple minutes. He's just like,
And I guess there is like a playful sense to it because he puts that sheet over himself. You know, yeah. Like there is like a cheeky vibe to him. I don't know about it. I don't think the evil guy has cheeky, but
yeah. Yeah, that was weird. I couldn't tell if I thought that fit or not. Like, but he could have seen that on TV or something when he was growing up. But go back farther though to when he kills Bob. That's that guy that he lifts up while strangling him with when we learn he has superhuman strength, basically, because he one-handed lifts Bob in the kitchen and then he stabs Bob all the way through and kind of nails him to the wall. And this is really subtle, but after he does it, he takes his hand away from the knife. He takes half a step back, and he's looking at Bob's body there, and he tilts his head to the side as if he's thinking to himself, like, he was taking in his work, or maybe he didn't know if what he was doing was going to work, or maybe he impressed himself. And it was like, again, I keep going to this childlike thing, and I don't mean for this to seem like a hypothesis that I have, but it's just a little motif that happens to match what I'm seeing. And that's that's what you would have if you were observing a child learning something for the first time. It was like a sense of discovery and satisfaction.
I mean, maybe they forgot his books at the institution, you know, so he still hasn't learned a lot. You know, he's kind of learning on the
course.
Yeah, that's right. Well, like, I have a question. Do you guys think Donald Pleasant, Dr. Loomis, do you think he kind of yada-yadded Michael Myers? Because, like, you know, he's never explained, but Loomis is talking about him a lot. You know, so it's kind of like, why is he out? Why did he drive? Why is he killing? He's just like, because he's evil. You know, like... You think that's a yada yada? Or I mean, I like it. I like that the character's not explained. I do. For some reason, it works on me. But do you think some people could see that as like, he's evil. You know, like we don't have a backstory. You know what I mean?
Yeah, in terms of plot, like, yeah, he's definitely kind of the yada yada, like a plot device guy. But I think in terms of like looking through his character's eyes, it's like this is a guy who spent like 15 years with the guy. So he just like, I think he just kind of like, he's like kind of burnt out and jaded on Michael Myers. And he's just like, listen to me. This guy doesn't talk. He's evil. Just make sure he doesn't leave. Like, that's all you need to know. Just trust me on that.
Yeah.
You know?
That was creepy in the beginning when they pulled up to the mental institution and there was just, like, darkness. But then you saw some, like, white coats, white outfits, institution outfits just kind of wandering through the grass. Yeah. Like, that was a good creepy opening right there for sure.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Like, I think that all you're saying about Loomis with the yada yada, I don't really think so. And so I've got two views. One, this is 1978, and storytelling in the horror genre was much simpler back then. However, for its time, that seemed more complicated, more articulated, if you will. Like, horror back then was so simple and streamlined that it almost seems dumb looking back most of the time. And that didn't seem dumb. That felt better thought out. So I thought that was a little ahead of time, the way that Loomis was going about explaining Michael Myers.
You thought, like, horror, like, are you talking, like, slashers? I mean, like, Rosemary's Baby and, like, Dawn of the Dead. Like, I think those were very intricate horror films at the time. So, I mean, I wouldn't say those were simple. I guess, like, the slasher movies were simple. Is that what
No. You see, you're picking like seminal films.
All right, guys. So I gotta ask, what do you guys think of Jamie Lee Curtis's character, Laurie Strode, in the movie?
She was just nice. Like, it was a nice character. Like, I think she gets not as much credit as she deserves, but I don't know. I thought that she was like a relatable. Like, everyone was talking about how much of a square she was, but she's really not that bad. Like, just a cool, likable human being, I guess.
Well, I don't know how cool, but she was very likable and nice, and it was really endearing the way she interacted with Tommy, the boy that she was babysitting that night, and talking about the boogeyman, which was a cool, you know, conversation to be having during that movie.
I mean, I think before Michael wrecked her life and, like, caused her to, like, go into become a recluse and, like, you know, insane, like, I think she probably would have been the cool person in college. I think she would have been, like, the, like, hip. Like the hip coffee shop person, you know what I mean? Like people be like, "Oh wait, she actually is pretty cool." That's my vibe.
But there was like a scene.
She was pretty wholesome.
Didn't they show her just like knitting something though?
I mean, that's great. Self sufficient. You know what I mean?
I guess.
Like if it gets cold out, you got scars for days.
Yeah, that's true.
She could have opened a shop after college. Scars for days.
If you had to compare her to like the other kind of. I guess, like, the slasher girls. Like, where does she rank, you think?
You mean, like, in the final girl?
Yeah, final girl. Like, where would Laurie Strode rank?
Well, it's tough because I think she was one of the first... I mean, I guess there was Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but she just sort of yelled a lot. I think she was kind of, like, the prototype for it, so I think everyone sort of improved off her. No, I mean, I think... Jeez Louise. Final girl. I mean, I think she was the foundation that everyone built off of. So you got to rank her high. I mean, maybe some people have been better, but I would always put her first.
I like how she fought back.
Why isn't Jess from Black Christmas first?
I'm not a Black Christmas guy.
Yeah. But that doesn't answer the question. Black Christmas was 4 years earlier.
I mean, but were there anything alike?
They were both likable. They had the qualities of final girls. They were the most wholesome out of all the girls presented. They were strong when they had to be, but they weren't irrationally smart or capable when they had to be. It seems like a good model. It's just that Jamie Lee Curtis, I think, was a much more convincing actress as a final girl.
Well, I want to apologize, world.
Yeah.
Jamie Lee Curtis is my favorite.
But I'm going to agree with you that Jamie Lee Curtis, like, she probably made a better impression because... I thought she was a better actress. I think she captured it better. You said she probably didn't get the attention she deserves, but I mean, for me, I'd say she does. And when she was fighting physically Michael Myers, like, okay, she stabbed him with a knife. I'm sorry, with a knitting needle in the neck. And then she stabs him with a straightened out coat hanger in the face. And then she stabs him with a knife. And at no point does she swing any of those weapons like she'd ever swung a weapon before. I don't think that's easy for an actress. It was always haphazard. Like she was swatting with a haymaker of an arm. And when she screamed, I swear to God, I saw her face do something no one else's face has ever done. Like her mouth opened up more than anyone else ever when she screamed. And when she ran down the hall, she was like, totally hunched over, like her body ached from the fear. So I think she did an amazing job.
Yeah. Just going back to that scene where she was hiding in the closet and she stabs him, you know, with the straight-on coat hanger. Did anybody else think it was really funny that Michael Myers just, like, he just took, like, the longest and most complicated way to open up a closet? Like, he just punched a hole in it and he just, like, just trying to, like, punch more holes in it when he just could have just.
Well, she had tied it shut. He doesn't know that.
Like you could have just. I don't know. I feel like there was a better way to open up that closet. I don't know.
Yeah, if he can steal cars, like, and I guess there were other, you know, scream queens. Obviously, you know, there was what Black Sunday, King Kong, like there, you know, Faye Ray. I mean, you probably couldn't hear her, but she was definitely screaming.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, like, you know, Argento had that, like, you know, Janet Leigh and Psycho. But I don't know. For me, I feel like this was one of the first that kind of kicked off this type of character. So
I'll agree with you in the sense that this movie was wildly more successful than, for example, Black Christmas was. Like, Black Christmas was a cool movie, and it gets a lot of positive critical acclaim. But when it came out, it had no impact on the world like this did. And so this touched more people.
And in essence, it reached out and touched more people, so it was more likely to affect more filmmakers after its time. I think that would be fair to say.
Would it?
All right, fine. Black Christmas it is. Halloween sucks.
You know what? I think we need to take some time to ponder some things. Like, I'm going to go find out the question of why Michael Myers took so long to open up that closet.
He's still working on it.
Yeah, I'm working on it. Still.
I mean, she tied that up really well.
It just befuddled me, I guess. I don't know.
That was like merit badge nodding.
I mean, her knitting came into handy. She knew how to, like, tie that up right there.
She's probably one of the best that has.
And she knew how to stab in the neck.
I wish she would have, like, sewed him to something.
That would have taken, like, when he fell, like, you know, because when he takes a bad hit, he'll fall, even though he gets up later. So, like, while he's down, she'll like, sew him to the carpet, like Gulliver's Travels.
Yeah. little effusions.
All right, guys, let's take a break.
Hey, y'all, it's Mark. And for you, the listeners of Movies, Films, and Flicks, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, there's a book that I really recommend to you guys, and since we've been talking about horror films tonight, it's a book called Shock Value: How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. It's a wonderful book. It's about 9 hours long, but it walks you through how Alien, Halloween, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, how the classics were made, Rosemary's Baby. And if you're a fan of horror, if you're a cinephile, and if you're just a fan of classic cinema, I totally recommend Shock Value. It's a wonderful book by Jason Zinnemann. Totally recommend it. So to download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/shark. Again, that's audibletrial.com/shark for your free audiobook.
Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I'll be honest, I still don't know how Michael Myers took so long to open up that closet. I don't think Laurie tying the closet from the inside really helped at all. You know,
I mean, how many closets have you really busted through?
If you're punching a hole through a closet, why can't you just undo, like, whatever netting Lori, like put over the door?
Like, I mean, he was wearing that mask. It wasn't easy. He might not have even been able to see that.
Why can't he just pull the doors off if you're busting holes through it? I don't know.
It has that iconic shot, though.
Oh, where he's...
which iconic shot?
You know, I would be bummed if I was reaching into my closet and all I had were, like, the plastic hangers. I mean, they do hurt.
Yeah.
But you're not going to gouge anybody with it.
If she snapped it, it would be sharp.
That's true.
Yeah.
And if you had enough time, which you probably would, if Michael Myers is trying to open the closet, you could kind of sharpen it into a shift.
That's He's there for 3 hours?
Yeah. Oh, this is going to hurt. This is going to hurt.
Wait. Before we get to the listener question, she gets, like, she stabs him in the eye, right? And eventually, like, while they're still in that bedroom, she stabs him. Hmm. And he's down. Right? Yeah. And she's down.
He drops the knife.
So I was wondering about this. Like, now, she doesn't live, in these horror movies, you assume that they don't know about all the other horror movies. Not that there were as many back then. But she knows that he's been stabbed in the neck and stabbed in the face, and he keeps coming at her. So when she stabs him in, like, the upper chest and he drops, like, some people could say she's just scared and that's why she runs off. But, like, I'm sitting there thinking, like, what about the other side of the coin? Like, why doesn't she just stab him, like, 17 times? You know, it's not even the thought process of, you know, one more to make sure. Just the hysteria, you know. I'd love to – whenever they walk away after that one hit and the killer's down, like, I always get so frustrated. Like, no, just take him. I don't know. What do you guys think? Maybe it's just me.
That's a common horror trope, though, when they always walk away. Like, after supposed death of the killer, right? But then he always comes back. Like, I think that's something they made fun of in Scream, right? Like, one of the tropes that they were just kind of lampooning.
And they did that in Halloween H2O again, too. She, like, stabs him. She's about to just stab him, like, 40 other times. And LL Cool J's like, no, he's dead. And I know. But I don't know. I've never been chased by a maniacal demon shape.
Well, that was her third movie, so by then she knew.
Yeah, but, like, I don't know, man. Maybe she just wanted to get to her kids. Like, maybe, like, you know, she just wanted to get the heck out of there. She didn't want to go closer. Maybe he could have been playing Myers possum. I don't know.
All right. It's time for our third listener question. Mark, what do you got for us?
And this one comes from the illustrious Donnie Brewski, a man of few words that are many. He just doesn't have much of vocabulary, and he talks all the time. All
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, all right, so this one is, why do I love Halloween H2O so much?
Why does he love Halloween H2O so much? This is the movie that came out in the...
98.
Yeah, the late 90s. I mentioned this before in the podcast. It's the Halloween movie my mom took me to see.
Yeah.
So, yeah, starring Jamie Lee Curtis. It takes place, obviously, 20 years after the original. It had a pretty good cast, right? LL Cool J, Josh Hartnett.
Josh Hartnett, Michelle Williams.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
One of the Aldas.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't know, man. Yeah, Joseph Gordon, JGL. It's just like, you know, I watched it again recently. And, you know, I've been, like, trumping in it for so long. And, like, I'll still stick by it. You know, I still love it. I think it's ridiculous. I think Michael Myers drives cross country, like, in a car.
So, like, what's
the... I want a journey of that, like we said before. But it's just funny, man. Like, you watch it again, and, like, it's basically like a Scream, Dawson's Creek kind of film where, like, the couples are waxing poetic using big words, you know? And, like, everybody just wants to have sex. LL Cool J's writing about it. Jamie Lee Curtis's boyfriend just wants to have it. And then they stay back from the trip just so they can stay and fool around. Like, it's three different generations, like, wanting to hook up. And, like, I mean, it's economical. I like the setting. I mean, I love Michael Myers. Like, I mean, I don't know. For some reason, when I watched it when I was 16, I loved every second of it. But I don't know. I mean, I think it's just one of those movies, if you're our age, you watch it at a time, and, like, you just sort of love it.
I could be wrong about this, but doesn't Halloween H2O just kind of disregard, like, some of the previous entries?
It picks up 20 years after, basically, Part 2 ended.
Part 2. So, like, everything in between, it was just kind of – it just ignored it.
I don't think there was a Paul Rudd, yeah.
Yeah.
Like Curse of Michael Myers, Return of Michael Myers, none of that happened.
Everybody already...
That evil TV station conglomerate in Part 3 didn't happen.
Season of the Witch, yeah.
People love that movie now. But I think it just came out at a good time. Like, I don't know, I'll stick by it, I'll watch it again. But, like, now you watch it and you're like, oh, brother. But, like you said, like, Jamie Lee Curtis has him dead to rights. And you're like, no. And then supposedly... she kills him, drives off a cliff, sticks him between a tree, chops his head off. Then he comes back again, and it turns out in the brief moments he had, he switched uniforms with the driver and snuck away.
Oh. I don't know. What?
And that's what it is. And then in Halloween Resurrection, he kills her.
Yeah.
She's like, I've been waiting for you in a mental institution.
So I just saw this last night, and I guess I didn't catch that because there was nothing to catch, and they reveal this in the next movie, but. Yeah, so I just saw this last night basically because of this question, I guess. But I got to say, like, this was not a good movie, but it was a fun movie. And there are a lot of things to love. Like, LL Cool J's character is waxing poetic about, like, he's basically talking about, like, sex literature. Like, right? Romantic literature.
Yeah, he's writing, like...
He's being all prosaic, reading his girlfriend these lines from his chapters while he's working his shift as a security guard. Like, that was just adorable. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt, like, checking a house to make sure it's safe. Like, when the owner of the house in the first, like, couple minutes of the movie, the nurse who worked for Dr. Loomis, she's freaked out. So JGL goes in to check the house, knowing that she's scared that someone broke in, right? He's going with a hockey stick, like he's going to hurt something. And he gets a little distracted when he's in the kitchen. He's like, oh, shit, there's a beer here. He's like, now all of a sudden I'm just here for beer. Screw the intruder. Like, yeah, this movie was a lot of fun. And the first 90 seconds gave, like, three fun, like, self-aware nods to the horror genre. Because in the first 90 seconds, you heard the sound of a knife stabbing into the flesh of a pumpkin. You had Joseph Gordon-Levitt randomly appearing with his hockey mask. Like, it was just a lot of fun, like, right out the gates. This movie knew what it was.
Yeah, and I don't know. I like the isolated setting. I like that Michael Myers went back to kill those two kids. Like, he's like, I'm going to – what was his plan? he's like, I'm going to sneak in here. She's going to run away. She's going to run to those kids' houses, but they're going to be killed by the time she runs in here. Like, it's just like a, I don't know, it's a cheeky little thing. Like, I don't know. I enjoy it.
I think for me, like, the movie, like, becomes, like, really fun to watch when Jamie Lee Curtis just kind of becomes, like, the crafty veteran.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, she, like, sends her son out of there. Like, normally the young kid's the hero, and she's like, get my son out of here! Then she grabs an axe and hunts him down.
Yeah.
That's right, and she straight up stabs him, like, in the shoulder with an axe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was nuts. When I saw that, like, it was just a big ear-to-ear smile.
And he does, like, the best one-handed, like, pull-up ever. Like, I guess he's dropping down. But, like, he's, like, dropping down with one hand behind her.
Yeah. But he set the precedent for that in part one when he strangled Bob and lifted him up with one arm. So that's, I know, right. He's got the strength.
Is that his right or left arm? I'm wondering. And he's also – I like that he didn't kill the little girl in the bathroom. Like, he didn't kill that family. He just stole her purse and car.
Yeah.
Like, well, I was like, don't kill the kid.
I don't think he's never killed kids, has he? Like, little kids. Like, I'm trying to remember, like, through all the Halloween movies. I know he didn't kill any kids in the first movie.
Yeah, I think he just kind of sticks to, like, promiscuous teenagers and his family.
Yeah. So he has, like, a code that he follows.
He's like Dexter?
Yeah. If they haven't reached puberty, they're good.
I'm not gonna. I don't know. So I think the reason is it just – I don't know. It's like, I think what John said was perfect. Levengood said it. It's not a good movie, but it's a fun movie.
Yeah. I just – for me, like, I'll always remember watching this movie with my mom in the theater. So yeah, that's kind of a weird connection I have with that.
I think it's even fair to say that this movie is good at not being good because it's self-aware.
Yeah, there we go. I mean, it built – and, like, you know, when she's hunting down Michael, like, that's a really – get your blood boiling. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's good at what it does. It's fun.
Did this movie come out before or after Scream?
After. Scream was 96. Yeah, Scream was 96.
So do you think it was just – like Halloween H2O, I mean, aside from the obvious anniversary, but do you think part of it was inspired by just kind of the meta, like, meta-ness of Scream?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was a reactive sequel that worked perfectly at 20 years, but there was a lot of hype behind it. I mean, you can, like, look at the Halloween world in almost three installments. You know, you have the first one, and then, like, the H2O sort of revitalized it, because, I mean, this made, like, $90 million at the box office with inflation, and then you had the remake, which was a big box office hit. So, like, Halloween's almost been revitalized three times.
Yeah.
That's right. That remake, which they I suppose, should have called H29.
Oh, hey-o.
But, and then, and to spell it out for us, they got to go 29 years later. Yeah. Like, Halloween, it goes Halloween, Halloween H2O, and then they go 20 years later. It's like, well, yeah. Like, I mean,
I didn't think that they meant, like, you know, welcome to water.
Yeah, it's like Jason goes to Splash Mountain. Oh, that'd be pretty amazing. Jason or Michael goes to Splash Mountain.
I want to see those pictures.
I want to see a lazy river tube chase.
I've done that before.
They have to run backwards.
That would be terrifying for anybody who's ever been on a lazy river.
It's do it for so long.
Yeah, my arm's getting tired.
He's just standing there waiting while you're running through the lazy river upstream.
So I'm sold. I think that answers the question. Running through a lazy river upstream.
Lazy river's the answer.
Okay. I think, all right, to continue on with the topic introduced in the first half of this podcast, where we talked about Halloween, I think it's time to talk about, in the second half, talk about Halloween.
Can we call it H29?
H29.
That's right. Rob Zombie's 2007 Halloween remake, which, by the way, so first off, I think it's a little more interesting if we mostly just compare to the original, but we can spend all the time that we want bashing this remake.
Let's compare it to the original. That sounds good.
I am fully supportive. Whenever we want to go on a tangent bashing this movie, that's okay. I really have one positive thing to say about it, and I'll get to it organically when I do. But yeah, we can knock this movie up and down. But the first thing, oh God, super brain fart right now. What was I just getting to? H29.
So, you want me to jump in real quick?
Jump in.
All right. So I don't think this is the Halloween remake people wanted. I think this is the Halloween remake that Rob Zombie wanted.
Yes.
Well, that's abundantly clear by the brutality.
It's like, you know, so, you know, we talked about the intro of the other Halloween where basically the kid is, you know, the Panaglide walks up, kills his sister. Then next thing you know, he's stealing cars and popping in and out of shadows and hanging people up with one arm and looking to the side and blah, blah, blah. But this one features like this little gangly kid with quite possibly the most profane family in the history of the world. His stripper mom is with a guy that's, what, in a wheelchair and who's the grossest human being on the planet. His sister is like the – I mean, she's all right, but she's still just like the gnarliest like teenager you could imagine. And he's just like this gawky little kid who wears masks, which is kind of like an homage to the mask from the first one that they find. And it's just like – but I was reading an interview with Zombie, and he said he didn't want to have a kid that lived in like a white picket fence house. He wanted to have like a real kid. But then he said he said in this interview that he knew a kid when he was younger that – ended up killing somebody else, but they said he just sort of freaked out one day. So he didn't want to make it seem like his family circumstances are what led him to be crazy. He said he wanted the kid to always be crazy. But you're watching this movie and you're like,
well, you're kind of not proving that point. Like, it's just like,
yeah.
How could it not be the family? Like, the influence of the family causing him to just kind of go evil, yeah. Right?
Yeah, that father, played by William Forsythe, like, he was just despicably abusive and clearly self-loathing about his being on disability for some injuries he somehow got. But he was just toxic to everybody in that household.
Yeah, he was, like, wiping stuff off the table and, like, he was just so, – and, like, it was just, yeah. – I don't know. It was – and then, like, Michael Myers ends up killing his family because his sister didn't take him out trick-or-treating, you know, and it's just, like –
I know what I wanted to get to when I was brain farting, and Mark, you actually ended up bringing me exactly where I wanted to be, and it was about the origins. So in the first movie, right, we have no reason to believe that Michael Myers is in anything but a totally normal, middle-class, healthy family environment, right? We don't have any reason to doubt that, at least. So, right, and the kid looks normal. He's got a nice Halloween costume. He just cracked for some reason and went to the dark side. So in this one, though, yeah, he's got the kind of like the welfare poor family. You know, mom is a dancer. His older sister wants nothing to do with taking him out for Halloween, but and his stepdad is super abusive. But he really loves his mom and his little sister, clearly. And his mother clearly cares about the whole family. And I noticed that the sociopathy that Rob Zombie was trying to lay down was very inconsistent. Because so he gave us, what, 45 minutes of this kid, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he gave us 45 minutes of exposition to do what Halloween, the original, did better in 6 minutes. But either way, that aside, sorry, Rob Zombie, if you're listening. But if you're listening, it's awesome that you're listening. But so that aside, like, this kid, so he has a very loving relationship with his mother. He clearly – they go out of their way to show us how much he loves his baby sister as well, in addition to his mother. But he's getting abused by his dad, but then he's hurting these small animals. And he's getting made fun of at school, but he just seems like a typical victim at school until he cracks.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I see a lot of things that don't actually add up. Like, he took so much time trying to give us evidence for Michael Myers cracking that – half of his evidence is supportive that he shouldn't have cracked.
Yeah. And like, so he was trying, like, so there's, yeah, it was, I don't think it was a good beginning at all. And I think it made a lot of money because people were really excited about another Halloween movie.
Yeah.
And I think, did you know anybody that likes the intro of this film?
No.
So no. And while we're at it, like I had mentioned earlier, I've heard a lot of people who say like some less than stellar things about the original. But when those people also spoke about the new one, it's not like they liked the new one. In fact, when they talk about this remake, they favor the original for what it was at its time very much. And that's that, this movie, this remake, it did the opposite of what you're supposed to do in to make a slasher effective. Because in this movie, you didn't care about anyone, and I'll come back to that later, but you did not really care about a single character except for the baby sister only when she was a baby and the mother who wasn't around very long and who was a tangential character. But there were no strong characters in this movie for you to root for. The only, if anything, this movie was designed for you to identify with the killer, even though you know the killer is supposed to lose.
Yeah, and like, yeah, remember how he got out? It was the dumbest scene I think of. Well, sorry, not the dumbest.
Oh my God, no, no, go, right, go.
So, yes. I don't know. In this movie, I don't know why he did it, but everybody's very dirty and grungy. It's basically the worst of humanity, except for maybe like Malcolm McDowell, Danny Trejo, the mom, and the little baby.
Well, that's just Rob Zombie's MO. Like, yeah. It's just like the world he portrays in all of his movies.
And so in his world, Michael Myers gets out because two drunk rednecks, one of them who works at the place, vile, racist, terrible, gross human being.
In the asylum, if you will.
Right? Yeah, in the asylum. This kid murdered a nurse, you know, when he first showed up at the asylum. Now he's been in his room. He's like a 6'6", maybe, Hulk, like hulking beast, right? They take a new girl into who came into a patient. They unlock Michael's room and they attempt to, you know, forcibly have sex with, rape her in front of Michael Myers.
With the door open.
Yeah.
And on top of that, they keep messing around with this huge collection of masks that Michael has, and they go out of their way to show him that they're messing with them, when in the movie, in these 45 minutes of unnecessary exposition, they make it very clear to us that he is fixated on those masks because they hide his ugliness, which seems to parallel his lack of morality, his moral bankruptcy that leads to him killing.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. but they leave the door open, right? And then they're like, what are you going to do? I'm sorry. Even if I was a terrible, mental institution worker, who was just the worst human being on the planet, I would not do that in Michael Myers' room. gosh.
Nope.
The whole thing was just, it just felt gross. You know, which is what Rob Zombie intended. Like, you watch any Rob Zombie movie, like, you never feel clean. You never feel good about it. You know, no. It was just like, well, okay, so I watched that.
There's a grime over it. But this one, it didn't have to be, though. That's a thing. Like, it didn't have to be a remake, a shot for shot Psycho remake, you know what I mean? It didn't have to be a cheeky thing. You know, it could have been a mean and nasty film, but he adds these characters that add nothing to the lore other than just make it a nasty piece of filmmaking.
Yeah, I'll add something else to that in terms of how he kind of violated what was done so well in the original. And that's that, okay, in the original we talk about how the lack of motive behind Michael Myers, why is he doing what he's doing, is what makes him so terrifying, right? Mm-hmm. And some people say, oh no, he was coming back to get his sister, but wait. In the first movie, the fact that they were brother and sister didn't exist. That didn't exist until the second movie. Whereas in this remake, Rob Zombie just decides, no, he knows it's his sister. He's coming back for his sister. So Rob Zombie, right out of the gate, has given you a sense of motive. And so he took away the mysticism of part one and then the big reveal and twist of Halloween 2. In one fell swoop, one line of dialogue, he ruined that.
And you know how Ebert said in the first one that, you know, that it didn't hate women. But this second one, the women's nastiness is like turned up to, you know, and the men's. It's like turned up to like 13. And then he tortures them. What is her name? Danielle
Harris.
She gets like, she's like the nicest one. And she gets lit up for like a long period of time.
She spent, I shit you not, it's probably 15 minutes of movie time. But I mean of actual screen time. You see her both topless and covered in blood and screaming or unconscious for what might have added up to 5 minutes of running time out of 15 minutes of scenes. This was the most drawn out, like, I was just waiting for her to die, the poor thing.
I kind of like, leave her alone, Michael.
Exactly. Yes, so, exactly. Like, that was horrible.
At least when Michael in the first one killed people, like, he did it pretty quick.
Yeah.
Like,
Now, hold on. I'm saying this is horrible, but I'm probably maybe the only one on this podcast. But just as a disclaimer for the listeners, I'm someone who adores the Saw movies and adores the Hostel movies. And yet I'm saying it was completely unnecessary the way that they drew out this girl's death.
And Martyrs. And Martyrs.
And I love Martyrs. Yeah. Oh, God, I love Martyrs.
But see, like, there was no reason for that drawn out thing. Like, it was just sort of. And then, all right. So I don't know if you guys noticed this, but the final chase scene. It's basically just him committing property destruction. Like, he rips through walls. He pulls off gates. He takes that board. He smashes a roof. Like, is this basically him destroying walls, ceilings, gates, and everything else? Like, I'm watching it. I'm like, did they have, like, were they bored? Did they have extra money? Like, did they just need to destroy a house? Like, it was just property destruction. It didn't scare me at all. Like, it was just him banging stuff.
Look, Rob Zombie. All right, so Mark is talking about it's the closing scene. It's in the old Myers house where he's now chasing his baby sister. So I think that they had 5 days left of filming. Rob Zombie, he gets a little note in his mailbox. It's like, yo, you erected this house on our Hollywood set for your scene. Well, someone's going to start shooting in 6 days, and you have 5 days left, so you're going to have to level this house. And so he basically put that Michael Myers actor into the destructor role to just level that house, which he basically did. I think he broke through three separate walls in that house, and a floor, and a ceiling.
You're just kind of like, just get to the point. And then she runs away, and she doesn't, like, fall into a manhole. She falls into a pool.
That happens.
Yeah. And then she's trapped in the pool. And then, you know, Dr. Loomis, Malcolm McDowell, comes to her rescue, which brings me to an interesting point about yet another thing that was squandered in this movie. We talked about how Danny Trejo might have been, like, the only likable character other than the mother, Sherry Moon Zombie, was, you know, for her brief part in the movie. Like, who ever felt like a hero in this movie? In the first movie, even though he's the unassuming hero, Dr. Loomis, right? Because he doesn't seem like the kind of person who should be a hero, but he plays a heroic Van Helsing-like role. And then Laurie, or Jamie Lee Curtis, she's a good final girl in the first movie, and we like her and we root for her. In this, I never cared about Laurie Strode. She was just another girl to be killed. And Malcolm McDowell did not come off as really caring. It was more like covering up a mess.
I for sure, like, you better go get him.
There was no, if there was a hero in this movie, it was Danny Trejo when he had no hope and Michael Myers was about to drown him to death, and he was saying, I was kind to you. That's the only heroic moment in the whole movie, and then he drowns. Like, that's it.
I don't know. And, like, he was just such a Hulk. I don't know. What I liked about the first one is, you know, they talked about him being pure evil in 21. So I figured maybe he's kind of, like, sneaky. He's kind of lithe. Like, he's kind of Jungle Cat-esque. But, like, in this one, he's just, like, a big Hulk. And I don't know how he got that way from just sitting around painting masks. Like, I don't think there's gym time.
He got that way from the criminally insane mental asylum gym where they emphasize powerlifting.
And lazy rivers that you got to run up.
Yeah.
Resistance training, right?
So let's... And you mentioned earlier, Danielle Harris's character, who had the most brutally drawn out kill, she was, like, the nicest character of all the of what I'll call the present day in the movie victims. Isn't that, I mean, sure, maybe Rob Zombie thought he was making a statement, like the antithesis of what we expect, but still, like, that doesn't please viewers. Being brutal and just being shocking for the sake of shocking doesn't satisfy us. It didn't satisfy me.
I felt bad for her. Just leave her alone, Michael. Yeah. So, Lazvath, what do you think about this movie?
I want to take it back to Levengood's point he made earlier that you don't, or it might have been Mark's point too. It was one of yous, or both. I don't know.
The Lazy River? That was mine.
Yeah. No, it's that you don't care about any of the characters in this movie, which is a hallmark of every Rob Zombie movie. Like, the space that his characters occupy, like, it's just a grimy, dingy world. Like, everybody hates each other. Like, they're all cursing each other. It's hard to... In a horror movie, you need someone to root for. You know, you always need someone to root for. That's not the killer. You know, Levengood made a good point. Like, you know, the remake it's like there were times where you were just rooting for Michael Myers. You know, the first 30 to 40 minutes of this movie were, you know, you kind of find out what, you know, Michael Myers' motivations were to turn evil. Like, that shouldn't be in the movie at all. Like, we shouldn't find out what his motivations were. You know, you're kind of bringing down the evilness of the character, you know?
They're naming him Toby.
Yeah, exactly. Every time I tell people, like, I tell people they should check out the remake after watching the original Halloween movies, but I tell them, like, just skip past, like, the first 30 or 40 minutes. Like, it's really unnecessary, you know?
Yeah, you don't need it at all.
And, like, honestly, if you skip, like, the first 30 or 40 minutes, like, the movie's, like, just fine, you know? Like, yeah, you're not really missing much. Like, it's a Halloween movie, and it's just, I don't know. This movie was, I will admit, when I first heard that Rob Zombie was doing a remake of Halloween, even though I wasn't a fan of Rob Zombie, I thought, well, that's a good combination, right? Rob Zombie, you know, classic horror franchise of Halloween. Like, that should be good. But, you know, I guess it was a case of be careful what you wish for, because Rob Zombie, he made a Halloween movie, but he also made a Rob Zombie movie, you know, and Rob Zombie movies don't exist in the same space as Halloween movies.
Even though I'd never say this, but this is the remake that I wish was remade scene for scene.
Yeah,
I think he would have done better if he did it scene for scene. I'm serious.
It didn't have like that kind of that slow burn that the first half of John Carpenter's movie had, you know. This one was just like, you just want to get over with.
I mean, and like the first scene, isn't it basically William Forsythe just like spitting food out? Is it William Forsythe?
Yeah, that's right.
It's like him just spitting food out. And you're like, I don't like these people. Like, you're immediately kind of, like, I don't know.
I don't like the dad. I don't like the sister. I mean, the mom's okay, but she's kind of hard to root for too. Yeah.
She was nothing but loving and affectionate. She just happens to be the stripper.
I mean, I guess it wouldn't be a, you know, like, and then he kind of showed it off. You know what I mean? Like, he had her do her scene.
Yeah.
He always has his wife do some very scantily clad scene, doesn't he?
Yeah, he just sort of threw that in.
Yeah.
He's very proud of his wife's body.
Yeah. I guess if you did fast forward it through there, but I guess, I don't know. It was weird. I was nitpicking, but I just thought the deaths were unnecessarily long, and then I thought he was just destroying a house for too long, and then she fell into a swimming pool
for too long.
Yeah, it's like just
they gave us the beginning for too long. The beginning was the beginning in the middle.
Yeah, and his hair was too long.
Yeah.
His hair was too long. They wouldn't have allowed that at the asylum.
Yeah, and you're right. They probably wouldn't have. Actually, it might be easier to corral him with that long hair. I'd probably just let him do what he wants.
You know, it's funny when you compare it to the remake. The original movie has like kind of this subtle finesse about it, in terms of how it does things, like how it sets up scares, how it sets up characters. Like, it's all very kind of subtly done. This one, like the remake, was just like a jackhammer. Like, here's a plot point. Here's a plot point. Oh, here's a kill. Here's a kill. And it's just like, okay, thank you, Rob Zombie. We get it.
Mm-hmm. He did two things that I liked, and the brutality isn't part of it. One, the nature of the mask. He did a good job, I think. It didn't need to go where it did with that unfortunate rape scene with the orderlies, but how they kind of revealed that was kind of like his gateway to not be seen for his evil. I kind of liked that, the way that was revealed. And the other was that Rob Zombie gave the absolute, I don't think that anyone could argue this, the absolute best depiction of ugly feet I have ever seen.
Yeah.
So Quentin Tarantino would hate it?
Michael Myers had the ugliest feet ever.
I don't remember what they looked like. It's like, What were these feet?
Don't Google it. Oh my don't Google God. It. Like,
you got to just when you get a chance, you got to find a YouTube clip, man. His feet were so, it was like he walked through mud, and then after that though, then he walked through the asylum for 2 weeks without ever washing his feet. So all the chunks of the dried mud are gone, right? But there's all this flaky, weird, like dry gray, dark brown skin. Like, these were the ugliest feet ever. Like, they look like their smell would knock me out unconscious.
So he's got the funky foot.
It's some jungle rot.
I'd rather deal with hobbit feet than Michael Myers feet.
But in all seriousness, though, these feet, they look like a lot of an inordinate amount of special effects work went into those feet for what we see for all but, you know, 10 seconds. I'm not kidding.
Half the special effects budget went to the feet. I can't confirm that, but it's my guess.
I think you guys know me. I really don't like dogpiling on movies. I think I try to find the positives out of them. Like, I think the only movies I really hate are Larry Crown and maybe this. Well, I hate Larry Crown more than this one. But so I hope you don't think I'm piling on it. But it's just, I don't know. Don't watch it.
I will Except for the feet. Yeah, I will say that it did reasonably well at the box office, right?
Oh, it tore it up. I mean, it was huge. It had a sequel. Yeah, like, yeah. It was a big film.
So it was good that it just revitalized the franchise because, like, after, Resurrection, it just kind of stalled again, right?
Yeah. I mean, Resurrection was, like, Busta Rhymes spin-kicking them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I think I had more fun with Resurrection because they were just saying that Michael Myers hangs out in the house eating rats. And then his film crew comes and he gets spun-kick. Yeah. Like, I'll take it.
Yeah.
Is there a spin-kick in this new Halloween? Imagine if that foot connected with somebody.
Oh, man. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you had to sum it up in two words, what would you say?
Fast forward.
What do you got?
Zombie ween.
Ooh. Okay.
Zombie. And I would say property destruction.
I thought you were going to say don't watch.
Yeah, don't watch.
No, I mean, I think it's worth watching if you're a horror fan or a Halloween
fan. Okay, so in all fairness, I rewatched this, right? So I saw it in theaters, and then I saw it right after I got the DVD, which was right when it was new, and then I didn't see it again until just this past week for this podcast. Yeah. I can comfortably say that each time I liked watching it, even though I would never recommend it. But maybe I liked watching it because I know I'm someone who overthinks movies, or I know I'm someone who's about to podcast it and make fun of it, and so I can embrace the things that I don't like about it, or I can write about it on our website, so I can embrace these things a little better than most viewers can. But I enjoyed watching it, and I like seeing different takes, even if I'm disappointed with it, because if I see 9 failures to see one great horror movie, it was worth watching all 10.
I mean, you gotta swing away.
Oh yeah.
Swing away, Meryl.
Just skip the first 45 minutes. Just do yourself a favor. Like, it's pointless. Like, there's no reason for that to be there at all. So
none. So that could be a nice short movie. Like, then it would just be like it is 2 hours long, too. It's like 2 hours and 2 minutes.
Yeah, and then cut the property destruction from, like, 20 minutes to 2 minutes.
The original was, like, hour 30? So, like, the remake, if you skip past, like, we'll say like the first 30 minutes just to make it equal.
Like, and then we'll take 10 minutes of Danielle Harris, who's naked, covered in blood, and screaming. Like, if you take away 10 minutes, there's still 5 minutes of her suffering. Yeah. We'll take away 5 minutes of property destruction, and we got a nice, tidy little, you know, like 20-minute movie.
I'm serious. There's a scene where he takes this log, and Laurie's on one side of the hallway and the ceiling. He's on the other side. So, like, it's a long 20-foot hallway. And she's far away from him, and he's walking with this log, and he's hitting the ceiling with it, like poof, and then he goes poof, and then he goes poof, and then he goes poof.
Isn't that what he goes? Walk down the hall,
and then he goes poof, and then he goes poof, and then he goes poof. Then you cut to her going, then you cut to him going poof. Then you cut to her going, then you cut to him going poof. Then you cut to her going.
I imagine it's gotta be so annoying. I'm like, I'm trying to go to sleep here.
It's just like he I don't know. It's just, and then he's bashing through walls and pulling gates and like,
yeah.
So this movie could be 30 minutes.
Yeah. Meanwhile, this podcast is it's getting up there. It's a little bit more than 30 minutes right now. All right, before we wrap up, are there any plugs you want to make?
Movies, films, and flicks. Follow us. I guess most importantly, guys, if you like the podcast, just make sure to, write a review or give us a good rating on iTunes. Or whatever you think is the rating that should be. And, yeah, check out Shark Dropper Paralyzed. They have a new one called Taco Tuesday.
Yeah.
They have a new one called Property Destruction Wednesday. They got another one called Dirty Feet Thursday. So just listen to all those podcasts and
I'm a busy
give them good and rate on them.
Also keep an eye out for Mark and Lemongood's post on Reddit. I guess like you guys have been posting on Reddit. A couple of your posts have kind of blown up there.
Oh, so. Yeah, exploded.
I think you guys posted like movies, films, and flicks on there. So keep an eye out for them on Reddit.
Lundgren's front kick.
Lundgren's. As in golf Lundgren.
Yeah.
Lundgren's front kick. We need a Kurt Russell one.
Yeah. Yeah, seems appropriate.
And watch Russell. Watch
Kurt Russell's deadly mustache.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. Russell's, oh, yeah. I mean, that thing's 8 pounds. And also, that movie Willow Creek is fun if you guys are ever bored. I enjoyed it. It's a Bobcat Goldthwait found footage film about a Bigfoot.
I'm going to go watch that now.
Sounds like something I want to watch, actually.
Yes, it's enjoyable. It's good.
Well, let's go watch it. But
yeah, right.
Before then.
Oh.
For my co-host, Mark Hoffmeyer.
Peace, love, property destruction.
Yes. John Lovegood.
Ugly feet.
I've been your host, John Rossman. Thank you so much for listening. See you.
Target. T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! Go! Go!
This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.